one of the clearest fossil records of the early universe are the supermassive black holes that reside in the nuclei of galaxies nowadays. Understanding where these black holes came from and how they grew is a very difficult problem, but if we assume that they're there, and if we make some assumptions about their masses based on observations, we can go a long way toward understanding what effect they have on the structure of the galaxies that they sit in, which is the subject of my talk. Let me begin by reopening this question of cusps that Lars talked about, stellar cusps. They're difficult to understand, but only if you ignore the black holes. In fact, if you assume that a galaxy has a black hole in its core or at its center, then cusps form naturally, as first pointed out by Peebles and Young some time ago. The mechanism is very simple. It's collisionless. As the black hole grows, it pulls in stars because of the increased gravitational force near the center. And this avoids the singularity problem that Lars alluded to, because although the density is going up very rapidly, the velocities are as well. Here's a simulation which shows the growth of three different black holes in the same initial model, which had a core. And you see that generically you form a very steep cusp. The density varies about as r to the minus 2, very similar to what you see in the faintest elliptical galaxies. Here are the observations once again. I'll just make the point that there really isn't a dichotomy as far as I can tell. It's true that if you look at profiles like these, faint ellipticals seem to have much different profiles than bright ellipticals. But in every case, the density near the center is a power law. It's just the index of the power law that changes. And that's shown in these bottom two plots, which show, for instance, gamma, the logarithmic slope of the density at small radii as a function of galaxy brightness, and as a more or less smooth variation from steep cusps in faint galaxies to shallow cusps in bright galaxies. There are no constant density cores. And the same point is made below in a plot from Carollo et al., who look at not the deprojected density, but the surface brightness profile, and once again they see a continuous distribution of slopes. What does this tell us? Well, it's reasonable to think that the faint ellipticals form their cusps via the mechanism that I just showed, the growth of a black hole. But what about the shallower cusps in bright galaxies? Let me mention one idea that Lars didn't, due to Roland van der Marl. It's a very clever idea. He said, suppose that all profiles look like this after the growth of a black hole, but suppose that you observe them at a fixed resolution, say here, then the slope that you infer at the smallest radius will depend strongly on what sort of profile you're looking at. If you assume, for instance, that the top profile comes from a faint elliptical and the lower one from a bright elliptical, then you'd expect to see a systematic variation in the inferred slope, just because you see more and more of the original core as you go down the series of profiles. So in his model, he had to assume that bright galaxies have smaller black holes in terms of the ratio of black hole mass to initial core mass in the galaxy. And he found that that set of assumptions very nicely reproduces the variation of cusp slope with luminosity from shallow profiles for bright galaxies to steep ones for faint galaxies. Well, it's a very nice, simple picture. One thing it doesn't do is deal with the merger problem. As many people have pointed out, I think John Cormody may have been the first, if you imagine that you make bright galaxies by merging faint ones, then the fact that faint ellipticals tend to have much higher densities than bright ellipticals means you're going to tend to form systems which are bright and which have steep cusps, because those steep cusps would be expected to survive during the merger event. And we never see that. One contradiction, or one counter-argument to that, was made a few years later. People pointed out that, after all, the bright galaxies which are absorbing the small galaxies also have black holes, and those black holes may disrupt the small galaxy and therefore maintain the low-density core. But that doesn't always seem to happen. Here's a simulation by Holly Bockelman and Richstone of this process. It's not quite an n-body simulation. What they did was they took a fixed potential for a large galaxy, which isn't shown here, plus a black hole at the center, and then followed the evolution of the secondary galaxy shown here with a fairly simple n-body code. The secondary galaxy didn't have a black hole itself. What they found was that in some cases it's true the central black hole from the background galaxy did disrupt the satellite galaxy. But if the orbit was changed, if the infall was on a more circular orbit, then the secondary could often survive, producing a bright galaxy with a very steep cusp. So this would seem to suggest that there's a problem with observations or with the model, in that you never see bright galaxies with cusps like this. We've checked this recently using full n-body simulations. This picture is based on the tree code called Gadget by Folker Sprengel, which has the nice feature that the time steps are very variable, which means you can treat orbits near the black hole very accurately. And what you see here again are contours of the secondary galaxy. The primary galaxy is there, but we don't show it. As it falls in, you can see that it's tidally affected, but nevertheless, the steep cusp that was there originally survives the event. So once again, you would expect to sometimes see bright galaxies with steep cusps. That's right, yeah. Well, do we have to reject the merger hypothesis? As Lars pointed out, there's another way out. And this is a result of physics that takes place on much smaller scales than what I just showed. It's difficult to use a code like Gadget to follow these much smaller scales. Here's a simulation based on a direct n-body code, the most recent incarnation of RCS n-body codes, n-body 6, or n-body 6++, as it's now called. It's a parallel version of n-body 6, which is designed for supercomputers, and that's how we ran this code. The initial conditions here are not quite realistic. You see two black holes in a background stellar density which has a cusp. One would like to put those black holes in their own cusps initially. Nevertheless, the plot makes the point that I want to, and that Lars made. As the black holes come together, they form a bound pair, and at that point, the density in the stellar cusp begins to drop. You can see that from the contours, due to this ejection of stars in three-body interactions with the massive binary. I'm sorry? You mean here? That's right. The ejection begins just when the binary becomes hard. That's right. There's no merger of the two black holes here. You just can't see them so close together. That's right. Yes. Right. The other thing you can see here is that these crosshairs are fixed in space, and they're centered on the initial location of the black hole binary when it forms. The binary then wanders around. It moves quite a large distance. So what's going on here? The physics are pretty well understood in general, although some of the details remain to be worked out. Once you form a hard binary, meaning a binary in which the orbital motions are of the same order as the background stellar velocities, it begins to eject stars that come near to it, and the process is just three-body interactions. In other words, a typical star has a much lower kinetic energy than that of the binaries, the binary black holes, and therefore most interactions cause it to be ejected with a large velocity. And the process is well described by two simple equations. The first gives the rate at which the separation A between the two components of the binary changes due to ejection, and the second gives the amount of mass in stars you have to eject to produce a given change in separation. The interesting thing here is that if the binary remained fixed in space, it would very quickly eject all the mass within its semi-major axis. In other words, it would produce a hole in the stellar density. If that happened, then the shrinkage would stop because there would no longer be a supply of stars. But what happens in the simulation seems to be that once that hole begins to form, the binary starts to wander, and that's what you saw in the previous view graph. There seem to be two reasons for that. The first is that once you have a hole, the density gradient is very small near the center, and therefore there is very little force to hold the binary at the center. And second, this binary is ejecting stars at large velocities. It's like a superelastic molecule, and that gives it much larger kicks than you would expect based on simple equal partition arguments. So these two effects combine to make the binary wander around, which is very important because then it can interact with stars at a much wider range of radii, which causes the coalescence to continue, or at least to go much faster. Here, in fact, is a picture from that previous simulation, but on larger scale. It's kind of messy. What's shown here is just the trajectories of the two point masses, the two black holes that let the stars out. And what you see in this plot, which has been broken into three consecutive time intervals, is that once the binary forms, once the two black holes find each other, it begins to wander more or less chaotically over a rather wide range in radii. This wandering was, I think, first noticed by June McKino and also in the study of Quinlan and Hernquist. And McKino made the interesting point that the amplitude of the wandering depends crucially on how many particles he had in his simulation, on n. In particular, the wandering dropped in importance as n increased. And he guessed that this was due to the fact that the interaction between the massive binary and the individual stars was a n-dependent process. It's a mass-dependent process. It's collisional. So you would expect there to be smaller perturbations as the number of stars in the simulation goes up. Quinlan and Hernquist didn't explicitly look at this question, but they did note that the rate of decay of the binary depends on n, and that's shown here. When n was small, the separation between the black holes decreased rapidly, but as you increase n, you find that the coalescence is much slower, which again, they said, was due to the same thing. The wandering was less efficient for large n, and therefore the binary couldn't interact with many stars. No, I don't think so, but let me come to that. Here's one more picture of that from Mark Hemsendorf using a different n-body code, which shows the distance between the binary and the stellar mass center. And again, he makes the point that as you increase the number of particles, that typical distance goes down. The wandering becomes less efficient. So it's been seen in a few simulations now. What does this imply, as has been asked several times now, for the time scale for those binaries to come together? Well, let me take this all the way to the end and ask how long it takes the binaries to actually coalesce, which would occur eventually via emission of gravitational radiation. You find that you need to shrink the binary by about a factor of 50 compared to its radius when it first forms a hard pair. If you take the optimistic assumption that the rate seen in those n-body simulations is the true rate, then you get a very long time. It's of order billions of years, maybe even longer. The authors of both of those previous studies seem to want very much to make the binary merge, and they both gave arguments why they thought that these timescales were overestimates. But I think conservatively, one would expect even longer timescales, since both simulations showed a strong dependence of the rates on n. So it's hard to see how those binaries can merge given purely dynamical interactions with the star, at least in a Hubble time. Well, people have noticed this and mentioned two possible results. One is that the binaries might persist for a very large fraction of a Hubble time. There's a number of consequences. Valtonen has emphasized that if you have an uncoalesced binary and a third binary comes in via a subsequent merger, you could have a strong three-body interaction between the black holes, which would eject one or more from the nucleus. In addition, many people, like Martin Gaskell, have noticed that periodic or quasi-periodic features in quasars or AGN may be signatures of periods associated with the binaries, either rotation periods or precessional periods. So there's a large number of systems which have been modeled in this way. The other extreme possibility is that some other process acts to cause the binaries to merge very rapidly, and the most likely such process is gas dissipation, since the same merger that brings the two black holes into the core would also bring gas in many cases. Here are some consequences of that. One is that if you merge the black holes quickly, they don't have as much time to do damage to the stellar nucleus, so you would tend to preserve cusp in that case. Also, as Lars mentioned, you may have star formation associated with the dissipation, which would also tend to recreate or maintain a cusp if it was destroyed. So in this case, you'd expect to preserve cusp much, much better than in the other. Well, which is the correct situation? And how does this relate to the properties of cores? There's a much-cited study by Kaufman and Haynelt, which addresses many things, but in particular they ask, what would you expect for the mass fraction of galaxies in gas? at their last merger. And this plot from their paper suggests that galaxies which are bright now formed from things which had relatively little gas in fairly recent mergers, while things that are faint now formed earlier from things with lots of gas. And I noticed that the transition between gas-rich progenitors and gas-poor ones occurs roughly at the same absolute magnitude as now separates the core from the cusp galaxies, minus 21 or so. So this suggests the way out. In other words, the reason we see steep cusps in faint galaxies is because they form that way and because subsequent interactions were very gas-rich, which for the reasons that I gave tend to preserve cusps, whereas bright galaxies used to have cusps, but now they don't, and that's because this process of interaction between the binary black holes is able to go some way toward completion in the absence of gas, which destroys the high densities of stars. But in any case, I think this picture, the cusp slope as a function of luminosity, tells us something about the merger history and the dissipation history of galaxies. Well, everything I've talked about so far has to do with processes very near to the central black hole. What about on larger scales? The field of elliptical galaxy dynamics has been a bit revitalized recently by the recognition that these galaxies always have central mass concentrations. And that's important because, as I think Gerhard and Binney first pointed out, if you take the classical families of orbits in a triaxial potential and embed a central point mass, you have a big effect on at least one of those families, the box orbits, because a star on a box orbit interacts or comes close to the center roughly once per crossing time. So if the large-scale potentials of galaxies are significantly non-axisymmetric, if they're triaxial, then you would expect at least some orbits to be from this family, and therefore a central point mass could have a large effect not just at the center, but at large radii as well. Well, if you embed a central point mass into a fixed triaxial potential and do orbit integrations, you find some interesting things. This plot is a kind of summary. It shows that the types of motion that you have in triaxial potentials varies with the distance from that central point mass. So this is a radial distribution plot. You find three well-defined regions, in fact. First, near the black hole, the potential is nearly Keplerian. This is the region where the enclosed mass in stars is of order the mass of the black hole. Roughly a few parsecs for most galaxies. And even though you have a contribution to the potential from the stars, it's not enough to break the nearly Keplerian nature of the potential. And what you find are orbits like this, which are nearly ellipses, but which precess due to the background torque from the stars. If you imagine populating this orbit above and below the black hole, which sits right there, you would get something very much like a box orbit. The difference here, though, is that the box is oriented perpendicular to the long axis of the stars, which makes it not very useful for self-consistent reproduction of the potential. If you go out a bit further, beyond this radius at which the mass in stars is of order the mass in the black hole, you find a sudden transition to chaos. And this is the old problem discussed a lot by theoretical dynamicists, where you have an integrable system with a central scatterer. That scatterer can do great damage to any trajectories which go near the center. This transition is really very rapid. That's shown here in a plot from Ming Poon's thesis. What she's done here is to look at five different triaxial potentials with different short to long axis ratios. And as a function of radius, or in this case, as a function of the stellar mass enclosed divided by the mass of the central point. So going to the right is going out in radius. She's plotted the fraction of the box orbits which are chaotic. And you can see that near the center, the orbits are almost all regular. There's a transition that occurs roughly where the enclosed stellar mass is of order the black hole mass, very rapidly to a fully chaotic region. And if you go farther still, you find that regular box orbits begin to appear once more. Well, the purpose of this work is ultimately to show whether or not one can maintain triaxiality in the central regions of a potential with a black hole. She hasn't gotten that far yet, but some observers have gotten excited by this question and begun to look for any evidence of a change in shape of galaxies inside and outside this region. And here are two fairly inconclusive results, I think I have to say, but noble attempts. The first is from a thesis by Timon. I think he worked with Ralph Bender, where he looked at this A4 shape parameter, the thing that measures boxiness or diskiness, at an effective radius and at this break radius, which is a few parsecs from the center of the galaxy. And he found, let's see, what did he find? Yes, that at large radii, you often could see either boxy or disky profiles, but at the inner radius, you only ever see disky profiles. In other words, boxiness seems to disappear roughly at this radius going in. But I'm not quite sure what that means in terms of the orbital dynamics. The other plots are from Barbara Ryden. These are those famous Hubble plots where you look at the distribution of axis ratios of a large sample of galaxies. And she did this both in the inner and outer parts of bright galaxies and found that in the inner regions, the distribution was consistent with oblate or axis symmetry, while in the outer regions, it was not, which again suggests a change in the shape. But exactly what sort of change isn't clear. Well, going back to this plot, this last transition at large radii occurs where the mass in stars is about 100 times the mass of that central point. Beyond that radius, you have a very interesting region where both chaotic and regular orbits coexist. What this suggests is that if you increase the mass of the black hole beyond about 1% the mass of the galaxy, that the entire outer region will be in the chaotic zone. In other words, there will be no region outside the center where the mass in stars is greater than 100 times the mass of the black hole. Okay? What I'm trying to say is, if you exceed roughly this mass, a black hole with 1% the mass of the stars, you might expect to see big changes in the structure of a triaxial galaxy because the orbits that you need to maintain it have gone away. They become chaotic. And that, in fact, seems to happen. Here's a simulation of a couple of years ago with Gerald Quinlan using the same code that Lars alluded to in the study of binary black holes. And what we did here was to embed and grow a black hole, a point mass, in an initially triaxial galaxy. And the plot shows the evolution of one of the two axis ratios, the intermediate to long axis, which initially was 3 to 4, but evolved toward axis symmetry as the black hole grew. And the three plots are for three different masses of the final black hole. What we found, and what I was rather surprised to see, was that when the black hole exceeds about 2% the mass of the entire galaxy, that transition to axis symmetry is very fast. It takes place in just a crossing time. I didn't really expect that, and I'd like to see it confirmed by somebody. Nevertheless, the basic result, I think, is solid, and that's because it's been seen many times before. For instance, Josh Barnes has noted that if you do mergers of disk galaxies with and without gas, you get very different final results. Mergers without gas tend to produce triaxial things, as indicated here by their orbital content, while things with gas tend to make much more nearly oblate final configurations. And the reason he speculated is that the gas in the simulations falls to the center. It makes a compact central object, in effect, which has the effect of causing the box orbits to become chaotic. In fact, I'll mention that Josh Barnes has wondered in print whether this mechanism that you see in the merger simulations is really the same as the one that Gerald Quinlan and I saw. The reason that he gives is in principle good. He points out that in this simulation, the central object was really very small. It was a point. Whereas in the merger simulations, the gas accumulates in a region of finite size, and he couldn't quite see how the scattering of box orbits that occurs here would also occur there. In fact, you can show that it is the same mechanism, at least in my view. And the reason is see if I can explain this in 30 seconds. The box orbits that exist in the presence of a black hole always look like this in cross-section. They're very thin. They have to be thin to avoid the black hole. And if you slowly make them thicker, there's a critical thickness at which they come close enough to the black hole to make them chaotic. In this case, weakly chaotic, but often more chaotic. So you can measure quite accurately how big a central mass concentration can be and still produce this effect by measuring how close the orbit has to come to the central point or central object to be perturbed by it. And that distance is not very small. That's what's supposed to be shown here. In other words, when the black hole approaches the sort of masses that you see in real black holes, that distance becomes something like a tenth of the half-mass radius. So even rather big mass concentrations can do this damage to the orbits if the total mass is large enough. Well, this provides a nice explanation for something which has been seen several times now in studies. People have looked for evidence of triaxiality in real galaxies and come up short, by which I mean that in most samples studied in this way, one can reproduce the velocity fields quite well with a sample of galaxies, none of which is very triaxial. Triaxiality can't be ruled out, but in most cases one finds a reasonable distribution of shapes like this one, which Back and Statler recently published. In other words, most galaxies seem to be nearly oblate, some nearly prolate, and few, if any, have to be triaxial. So the fact that ellipticals are much simpler systems than we thought they might be about 10 years ago is probably due in large part to the central black hole. Thank you.
Statement about axisymmetry inconsistent with Ryden's conclusion from the distribution of shapes or consistent with it? Because I thought she was arguing that you couldn't get a set of oblate or prolate.
That's right. Her statement was that in the bright ellipticals at large radii, one needs some triaxial objects. That's the claim, if I understand it.
Okay, but so I think not necessarily inconsistent.
I don't think it's inconsistent. Statler. Right. Also, those are the galaxies where the time scales for this evolution would be the longest.
I was just wondering, based on your results, whether you are or are not surprised to see bars in so many galaxies, because presumably you can extrapolate this result and find that bars should be destroyed.
A great question, yeah. Yeah, I don't know the answer. I think the state of the simulations of bars is very much, confused. Some people find that bars are destroyed by central point masses. Others find that you can actually make bars by growing a central point mass, and everything in between. So I don't know. I'll just make the statement that bars are rather different geometrically and kinematically from the systems that I talked about here. I think it's very likely true that one can maintain triaxiality even with large black holes if the initial configuration is carefully chosen, and nature may do that. Another point is that the statements that I made were about rapid evolution were only in the case of very large black holes, whereas, for instance, the Milky Way's black hole has a mass which is among the smallest of any known in units of the bulge mass. It's too small to produce much evolution over a Hubble time.
But back to the coalescence of the black hole idea. If I understood you correctly, the thing that's making it not coalesce as quickly, when you go to higher end, is just basically that these little perturbations aren't allowing it to wander much. So it's the
that's
wandering
right.
really that's driving the
that's
rate
right.
of evolution. But if you were to simulate the entire object instead of just the very central region, which is what you're doing, clearly all this substructure and stuff that we've been hearing about all day is going to excite different modes within the galaxy, and that's going to cause the center to wander around as well. And wouldn't that then recover your quick evolution?
Well, I suppose it might happen. On the other hand, the black holes are going to make a very dense region around them, and I think that region will follow them wherever they go. Gosh. I don't really know. It should be checked, I suppose. But I'd be surprised. The wandering affects such a large radius that I don't think you could do very much with very small scale.